Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Alrighty, welcome back to episode number 122 of Unblocking Crypto. Hal, you're joining us from El Salvador, which is going to be something we definitely want to chat about here shortly. How is it down there?
Oh man, it's pretty awesome. Like, it's what I wanted, which is not a touristy vacation. Salvador is not really built for tourism, I would say. So yeah, I'm enjoying it.
Yeah. So apologies ahead of time for any of the recording or speech issues that we're probably going to experience with him down there, but let's jump right into it. So I guess the first thing that I saw that I wanted to chat about was Biden officially vetoed SAB 121. So he did what he said he was going to do, even though everybody told him not to.
Yeah, I saw that and was like, somehow mildly surprised, like, to actually see it, you know, like I mentioned a few weeks ago, he said he's going to veto it. And then there's kind of a winds of change going in the direction of pro crypto in Washington. And he stuck with it. I think it's dumb. And I especially in light of the red team being more pro crypto and more people viewing it as something that might swing a vote. So yeah, I feel like Biden is stacking up losses.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I feel like he just lost the crypto vote. Although there's a ton of news out there saying that the tide is turning in his camp, that he's becoming more crypto friendly. But this veto doesn't show that at all. I mean, you got guys like Trump now who are officially accepting Bitcoin Lightning payments, which he's the first candidate to ever do that. So, or major candidate, I should say. So, and Biden still doesn't accept any crypto payments. So I'm not really sure why they're saying Biden is more pro crypto, or because all he's doing is fighting against it. And apparently it sounds like Elizabeth Warren sent a letter to Biden telling him to veto it. And he's still paying attention to her and to Gary Gensler. So yeah, kind of frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, this goes into like the blue team having a consistent message of, we'll just keep saying that we're something and we'll keep doing the opposite and see how that works, right? Like, so yeah, they'll probably say they're pro crypto and then keep doing actions like this because 80-90% of the population doesn't pay attention to like the boring news, what actually happens. They only pay attention to the 5-second headline of what the media says. So maybe that's a piece of it, but they're definitely not. I mean, this was their chance, right? It's basically with the early June, they're 5 months away from an election. So this could be the chance to pivot into more of a crypto reasonable position. And they chose not to.
Yeah. So I guess the other thing that was kind of interesting, I was reading a little bit about the FIT 21 that passed the House, I think, last week and was going to the Senate or going to be voted here shortly. And it sounds like, based on what everybody's saying, is the younger people get it. The older people there don't get it. So it's still almost an age divide that if you're old, you probably don't understand crypto and you're not very optimistic about it. Whereas everybody that's younger, I mean, you look at Bukele, who's, 42 years old and is a dictator that is all in for crypto. And then you have a Joe Biden who's 80-something years old and all against crypto. It's an interesting perspective to look at when you start looking at age and how that affects your beliefs in this too.
Yeah. And I mean, if you flip that around, if you're the blue team and you usually get the young vote and young people are more pro crypto, you're not really playing to your base. You're not, you know, you're if you lose people because of the crypto vote, you're losing the people. And that's usually who's voting on, you know, for Biden and the blue guys. That doesn't make sense. It's like crypto is breaking their brain.
Yeah. So the other thing that was kind of interesting is that Argentina and El Salvador have been in the news here recently. And I don't know if you saw much about this, but Argentina opened up some discussions with El Salvador on how to, with El Salvador's Digital Assets Commission, on how to use Bitcoin as an actual currency in their country. So they're intrigued with what El Salvador is doing and they want to talk further, which is huge steps.
Yeah, I have seen that. I saw that Malay was in town. So when we came down on Thursday, on Saturday, Mukaili was inaugurated again for his second term. And so there's been several different, well, Biden sent some people here for the inauguration. A lot of crypto influencers, Bitcoin folks came into town, and then a lot of Latin American delegations came too. But, you know, the president of Argentina coming down is worth noting, especially since we thought he was pro Bitcoin, and then he's kind of not pro Bitcoin. And now he's kind of, you know, it doesn't seem like he's got a firm position on it. But if you start talking to people like Bailey, and he's having success from the sovereign wealth investment, right? He's up 20-30% in US dollar terms and still stacking. So for me, Milei coming in and having those conversations is a good thing, especially, I mean, El Salvador was on the US dollar, right? Argentina sees way worse problems than El Salvador on inflation.
Yeah. Yeah. So I saw Bukele started his second term, and there was an interview that apparently Kathy Wood had with him, which was kind of intriguing. And what she got out of that with is that what Bukele is doing should 10x El Salvador's GDP in the next 5 years. And I did a little research to see kind of where they stood, and they're at like 101st right now, or somewhere in that general area, which is kind of middle of the pack for all the countries out there. If they 10x what they're doing in 5 years, that would jump them all the way up to like 45th based on kind of the numbers that I was seeing. So that's a huge jump for a country that size.
That is a huge jump. And so being in El Salvador for the last, since Thursday, so what is this? That's like fourth or fifth day of the trip. So I'm intentionally outside of like San Salvador, and we go to El Zante tomorrow. And so from what I see, you know, the Bitcoin adoption is a little slow and clunky. Like in order for me to pay for my like incidentals at that hotel near the volcano, I had to, instead of being able to pay for it at the front desk, I had to go to the bar because the bar accepted crypto, or the person at the bar knew how to do it. So there's a language barrier for me. Like my Spanish is good enough to survive. My Spanish isn't good enough to explain that I would like to pay in Bitcoin and kind of have a nuanced conversation. And so I can ask if I can pay in Bitcoin. If they say no, I just give up, right? Like there's not a lot of conversation for me, but I'm able to pay in Bitcoin. But even there at the hotel, that was an on-chain Bitcoin payment, not a Lightning payment. So she actually took a picture of my transaction to confirm that it went through. And I had to type in the number of sats in order to calculate, you know, the dollar value equivalent to close it out. So for me, we're in year three for El Salvador's adoption. And I'm looking forward to seeing El Zante and Lightning payments and everything smooth. I mean, when I was given my Airbnb in El Zante, I was given the direction and address and everything. So I Google mapped it, and, you know, in El Zante, like walking distance pops up the Bitcoin hardware store and things like that. So I think I'll be able to get a good, by the time I leave, I'll have a good picture of what the Bitcoin adoption looks like on the slow side and what it looks like when a whole community buys in. And so I think that'll be useful for me to kind of get a picture of what's Bitcoin look like when it's organic and bottom up like El Zante, and when it's top down and people don't understand Bitcoin, they're just told to use it, right? So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, no, that'll be interesting to hear. So sticking to the Argentina piece, there's the president of Argentina was pretty busy as well. He talked with the head of WorldCoin and is talking about possible investments of their technology and AI in Argentina as well, which is intriguing. And then the other thing that I saw too was that there's a kind of the crypto founders in Argentina are really pushing to start a blockchain valley, kind of their version of Silicon Valley down there. Since Argentina's economy has been hit so hard, they kind of have an opportunity to gather all this talent and focus them onto some blockchain projects and create this economic zone that is very positive for blockchain growth moving forward. And it sounds like that the president's advisors are all on board for this to happen in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. So exciting stuff going on with Argentina as they continue to try to fix all the issues they have on their end.
Yeah. And after kind of seeing El Salvador and, you know, this is 5 years of Bukele, you know, I think it's going to take a long time for Milei to turn that around. You know, it's fun to talk about and, you know, they come out with programs and they do kind of press releases on what they're going to do, but for it to actually make its way throughout the entire country, I mean, it takes a lot of time. So they should do it, right? I mean, the best time to improve is right now, but yeah, just they've got a long way to go.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think Bitcoin's going to be stopping at any point, but it's good that they're working towards that. If you look at some of the ETF side of things with the Bitcoin ETFs, it's official. BlackRock is bigger than Grayscale. It took 96 days for them to overtake it. I think last I saw it was like 19.68 billion versus 19.65 billion. And that's still crazy that Grayscale had the lead that they had. And now BlackRock has taken over, and you're starting to see BlackRock even adding that Bitcoin ETF into some of their own individual funds. And I think that was in their income and bond funds. So they had like $4 million or so of blockchain or Bitcoin exposure, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the more I think about it, the more I would have fired my CEO if I lost 300,000 Bitcoin and had that kind of lead. So yeah, I think BlackRock just gets it. I mean, they turned the entire ESG narrative off. You know, that's a lot of power. Like that thing that was going on for years. I mean, countries were making real decisions on power, on electricity and generation, and people were moving money left and right and to get into these more green technologies and companies, and companies were changing there too. And now it's like, all that's gone. Like that moved really quickly. And so, yeah, for BlackRock to move in and say, okay, we're going to turn on Bitcoin, and everybody just seems to listen to them, right? I mean, that when they say ESG, then money flows into ESG. When they say Bitcoin, money flows into Bitcoin. So I'd say not exactly the OG Bitcoin way to do things, you know, through BlackRock, but, you know, what are the Bitcoin is money for enemies. So you kind of, not that you pull for BlackRock, but it's getting to more and more people as investors buy BlackRock and other point spot ETFs. So let's see where this goes, but I feel like it's still just getting started. I mean, a lot of these companies, like those filings exposing everyone's exposure and ownership of Bitcoin ETFs really just now coming out. So everyone and competitors can see what the market's doing. And see, you know, if they need to establish a position, a Bitcoin position, you know, they haven't had to make that decision with urgency yet. And quite frankly, those guys it's like they just ignored Bitcoin this entire time. But here we are at, you know, over $1 trillion market cap. I don't know how you can continue to ignore it, especially if the people in your industry are buying it and you know it.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you look at this and they now have 11 days of positive inflows into Bitcoin. We're 4 months into the ETFs actually being live, right? And for the first three-ish, that was all positive. So this is the second longest length of positive inflows. And we talked about a while ago is it's probably needs to be at least 6 months to maybe even longer before most of these institutions really start to buy. So we're 4 months into that. 6 months. So don't even expect to see any fireworks really until at least 2 more months from now, if not later.
Yeah. And 2 more months from now is usually the time from the halving when the bull run really gets fun and everybody starts piling in and FOMO happens and you get some of that hyperbolic price increase. So I'm here for it. Like, let's do it.
Yeah. And there seems to be a lot of activity with the Ethereum ETFs as well. So BlackRock came out and mentioned they already have a seed investor that's going to buy 400,000 shares at $25 a pop. So they have $10 million already kicked into the bucket as soon as it launches. Franklin Templeton came out and said they're going to do a 0.19% fee. So they're the first one to talk about theirs. It's the same as their Bitcoin fee as well, which is kind of the lowest one out there. Fidelity has now, I think, the fourth person that's had their ticker listed on the DTCC, which means things are getting close, and there's still thoughts that we could even see an Ethereum spot ETF by the end of June, if everything works out.
Yeah, that's what I read, was end of June would be kind of maybe the realistic scenario, maybe not best case, maybe not worst case, but kind of mostly likely. And man, you've come a long way since last month when it looked like that thing was dead. So I will look forward to seeing what happens. You talk about Biden stacking crypto losses. I feel like the SEC is right there with them. That they basically gave the cold shoulder for months on the Ethereum ETF, and then somebody tapped them on the shoulder and said, get this thing moving. So they did. And then meanwhile, today, Berkshire Hathaway shares dropped $625,000 a share to like $185. I'm like, all right, SEC, where are you? I feel like that sort of digital error, because I went on my Schwab account just to look at, see how things are going, because Bitcoin price is up and I've got a bunch of Bitcoin exposure through MicroStrategy and ETFs and things like that. And it gave me a warning that was like, hey, we've got some pricing may be wrong. There's a technical difficulties, and Twitter's blowing up about Berkshire Hathaway and multiple companies being way off on their stock price. So, you know, maybe like GameStop's back at it again, like Roaring Kitty had like $180 million position that he tweeted about. You know, SEC's got problems, man. Like they can't even approve or not approve ETFs in a normal way. They've got tons of problems in stock market accuracy and price. And like they just need to get to work. You know, if they would just give regulatory structure so that people can follow it, then they can get back to doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I think Coin just tried to force the SEC to provide some regulations, saying that they're trying to kill the industry. And the SEC comes back and says, you can't force us to do anything. We think what's written provides everything you need to know. And yet when crypto companies try to do what is in the law, which there isn't really much there, they come through and try to fine them and say, you're doing it wrong. Like there's no clarity, no regulation, and it's a mess right now. So, oh man. I mean, you look at the Ethereum ETFs, we are still behind what I think they're missing the boat from an Ethereum perspective, where they don't allow the staking piece of it, right? So the European counterparts on our end have staking in their ETFs, so you can get that additional yield. That's not the case with the U.S. They're not going to allow it, unfortunately.
Right. So again, if the SEC, it's almost like they'll allow the Ethereum ETF, but no staking. They'll allow the Bitcoin spot ETF, but no in-kind redemption, right? It's like, yeah, we're going to take a little chip away and not give you the full thing. Now, I don't know if I understand staking well enough to be like, oh, the SEC should definitely allow staking. It's totally safe and reasonable. And, you know, there's no retail investor protection by disallowing staking. Like I'm staking crypto in my junk crypto stuff. I expect it all to just disappear. Like that's just, I just don't know enough about it. So I don't know. I don't know about that, but like the in-kind redemption to me is a little bit weirder of a move for the SEC on the Bitcoin side, because that's a well-understood component to this. It's just, instead of going out of Bitcoin and into dollars, you can just trade Bitcoin back and forth among the ETFs. So they're just very slow to try to understand it. And maybe that's it. Maybe they just don't understand what they're talking about.
Well, I mean, I don't think they understand what they're talking about. If you look at DebtBox, which the SEC sued, I think the end of last year, there's a federal judge that just awarded DebtBox $1.8 million for the SEC to pay them the legal fees for what the SEC did. And I mean, it's just the SEC is being a pain in the ass and overstepping their bounds and not following what they should be doing. So if, I mean, they're just, they're frustrating, right? And it's, I don't know how it gets fixed. Gary Gensler getting out of there would be a helpful fix, but in putting Hester Pierce in there, because she has great ideas that nobody listens to, unfortunately.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, I don't remember how old Gary Gensler is. He doesn't seem to be the 70, 80 year old of the Bidens and Warrens and those, but you know, he taught classes at MIT on the blockchain. He understands crypto at a deeper level than most other politicians and people in Washington, but he's old enough to like what his next job should probably be retirement. So why is he holding this anti-crypto line for Elizabeth Warren? If he doesn't, what does he have? One more job left after this? Say again.
He's 66 right now.
Right. 66. So next year he's got like mandatory Social Security withdrawals. Like he's done. Your career's over, man. You're going to do another 5-year stint somewhere make money doing Bitcoin and regulation speeches to BlackRock and those guys and get paid, you know, $150,000 to do a 2-hour speech and retire and just be a consultant, man. You're 66 years old. Why are you listening to other people at this point in your career? So I do not understand what the SEC is doing and why they're doing it the way they are.
Oh, shoot. He's got like 15 years before he can start to run for president with the age that we're looking at presidents these days. So he's prepping for that.
Good point. Maybe he's got he's 66 years old with a 30-year career plan.
So I did see Hong Kong came out with a list of exchanges that were deemed to be licensed. So they listed 11 exchanges. I think there's two already that are grandfathered over there, but that's exciting to see. I think there's a lot of frustration that they're saying, hey, they're deemed to be licensed, but they're not licensed yet. So why are you telling everybody this? But at least you have them moving towards having more options from just two guys to 13, theoretically, in the near future.
Yeah. I mean, the global kind of rollout of this sort of thing, it seems like ever since the United States accepted the Bitcoin spot ETFs. I mean, Australia's releasing stuff, the Hong Kong stuff. Like, it just seems like there's momentum, more and more momentum now that the US broke loose.
Yeah. And then I don't know if you saw the Japanese crypto exchange DMM. Looks like they got hacked for over $300 million in Bitcoin. So, and if it's truly a hack, that I guess no one's really come out and said this is yet, but it was weirdly set up into like 500 Bitcoin increments and set in like 10 different wallets. It would be like the 8th largest hack in the history of Bitcoin on dollars wise. Right. So one more reason not to keep your money in exchanges and hold it in your own wallet.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it comes down to like, do you really trust the SEC to be regulators? Do you trust the government to govern? Do you trust the crypto exchanges to custody your crypto? Like, I don't know why you trust anybody. Like the world has really come Bitcoin's way after, I mean, COVID, like who do you trust to give you advice and news and the truth? So, yeah, I mean, stop trusting other people and just hold your freaking Bitcoin on a hardware wallet, you know, like something that you can hold in your hand. And it sucks, man. I would be ticked off if I stacked sats and was just buying through an exchange and then all of my Bitcoin disappeared. Like, I guess part of me would be mad at the exchange, but I'd really be ticked off at myself.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you saw too, there's another company that's kind of following in MicroStrategy's lead. Selmer Scientific, which is a medical device company listed on NASDAQ, just came out and said they bought $40 million of Bitcoin. Their total market cap, I think, is just over $200 million. It's like 20% of their market cap is in Bitcoin. Apparently, their stock jumped 33%. And if you look at the last company that did this over in Japan 2 months ago, their stock tripled. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with them, but it's great to see other companies saying, oh yeah, we're going to take our cash that's sitting there and put it in something other than just cash.
I'll be honest. I've been a business owner and I've managed my own finances primarily and getting a little bit into Bitcoin years ago. And now it's like, man, I couldn't have gotten into Bitcoin in a big enough way, but in 2017 and 2018, my understanding of everything was so elementary that it was very speculative. right? And that's whenever I hear people talk about Bitcoin as a speculative asset, it just means to me that they haven't done enough research and understood it long enough to realize that it's way less speculation. And so if I had a company and I've gotten into Bitcoin a little bit, I can see how Michael Saylor got to where he is. I can see how these companies get to where they are. They didn't get there in a day, right? They didn't listen to one speech from one guy and then you put 20% of their market cap value or worth of assets into Bitcoin, right? It takes a lot of time to really understand things, convince yourself and, you know, go to El Salvador and see it up for yourself and spend it and, you know, exchange it instead of using Venmo, using Stripe to settle things among friends and things like that. The more you do that stuff, the more you really start to feel like, oh, this isn't a speculative asset, right? This is a hard asset.
Yeah, no, I was talking to my wife about your trip and she's interested in doing a trip just like yours at some point too. She's like, oh, that sounds really cool. So yeah, I think the more people get involved with it, the better. And speaking of getting involved, we talked about Tether kind of divesting into other areas. They just spent $100 million to buy shares in a Bitcoin miner. And I think they even have an option to buy another $50 million in the next 12 months if they want. But that's, I mean, a stablecoin issuer that is kind of jumping all into the Bitcoin mining side. The company that they invested in is called Bitdeer, and they have their own Bitcoin mining chip that just came out, the CL01, that is supposed to be lower power and better than anything else out there. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that and if they try to sell it to others or keep it all to themselves. But yeah, exciting stuff there too.
Yeah, man. And so for me, you know, after the halving and, you know, that I feel like the difficulty adjustment's still kind of in the feedback loop after the ramp up of hash rate and then the decline. To me, getting into Bitcoin mining right now seems like there's quite a bit of uncertainty. Like you just don't know what the transaction fees are going to be. But yeah, I read that Ted Cruz bought some Bitcoin miners. So we've got a U.S. senator that's mining Bitcoin. I saw RFK Jr. bought some Bitcoin for each of his kids. You got Tether doing even more because they hold some Bitcoin, but you've got them doing even more Bitcoin friendly stuff. You've got China selling U.S. treasuries and buying gold, you know? So like you have these moves away from traditional fiat based investments and more towards hard assets. And I mean, it's, you know, Bitcoin miner or gold miner, right? Like they're the same mentality gets you to arrive at the same investment or a different investment. Right. So to me, that's an interesting piece for Tether instead of just buying Bitcoin and holding onto it to actually get into miners. And I would assume they view that as like a leverage play in the Bitcoin exposure. I find that to be a little risky. You know me, man, I just like to buy Bitcoin and wait.
Yeah, no, I think that's true, but it's interesting that a lot more people are trying to make it easier to just deal with crypto in general. PayPal just mentioned their stablecoin, the PUSD or PYUSD is going to be launched on Solana pretty soon. It was a year ago, they put it on Ethereum. MasterCard just announced their crypto confidential, which is the ability to kind of create an alias and send money to an alias that people are connecting their crypto wallets to, and then they can confirm whether or not that alias can accept that crypto in whatever format it is. So whether it's Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana, whoever it is, and then they'll prove out that it will work before you send it. So you don't kind of lose it if you send it the wrong way. Unfortunately, it's really just being tested out right now in Latin America, but their expectation is they'll roll it out to more people in the future. But I mean, that's kind of a huge step forward to making it easier for people to deal with crypto and kind of using that Web2 interface with the Web3 technology.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that much in the last few weeks or months, but you know, that's the main piece for me for mass adoption. I mean, I'm in El Salvador transacting in Bitcoin and it's kind of clumsy. You know, if the receiving side hasn't bought in and understands it, then it's not that easy. So, and then I can't speak Spanish well enough to really walk them through anything. So if you've got MasterCard finding ways to be an interface so that it's easy to transacting in Bitcoin or crypto, that's a huge help, right? Because MasterCard and Visa are 1 and 2 for like trusted credit card companies and financial transaction people. So that's not a terrible thing, because I sweat it every time I move Bitcoin around. Did I somehow copy and paste the wrong address? Like, did I somehow mess this up? And so for somebody that doesn't have 7 years of understanding and some experience in it, like in order to do that first transaction, doing it through MasterCard will be a lot easier for them.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Every transaction I make, I still worry if I screwed something up.
Yeah, I settled my incidental account at the first hotel in Bitcoin, and it was an on-chain transaction. They took a picture of my phone with the confirmation of the transaction, because it was, we're not going to sit around and wait for 10 minutes. And so like if MasterCard is involved, that goes away, right? MasterCard will just send them a receipt. So I don't see that as a bad thing when you're trying to get more people to transact using Bitcoin.
Yeah. So the other things that I saw that were interesting, and you're probably not going to care nearly as much about this, but one of the other L1 blockchains is Near. And in the last 9 months, they've gone from about 300 transactions per day to over 6 million per day. So they're growing quite a bit. Now the wallets have really only kind of doubled in that amount of time. So it's not that they're adding a ton of growth, but it's people are using that chain a lot more, which is really exciting to see. And that kind of dovetails into the whole gaming side of things too. So most people are familiar with Telegram and their layer one, which is the open network called TON, T-O-N. They are going to, as of today, start requiring a lot more KYC. And I say a lot more because now all you have to do is put in your name, phone number, date of birth. They didn't really do any of that before, but they're starting to do more of that. And we talked about gaming being such a big piece in the future to bring a lot of people into crypto. They're about to roll out another game called Hamster Combat, which sounds kind of interesting, the little that I read about it. But if you compare it to, I think Notcoin was the other big Telegram group on that, they had like, Notcoin had like 7 million subscribers. This one has about 20 million. So almost 3x the number of subscribers, and Notcoin went up to almost 1.5 billion of market cap at its high. So if something like that is really going to drop and give people a bunch of free tokens that create a lot of opportunity, then it's going to be interesting. Now, will it be available to people in the US? Who knows? That's always the problem.
Yeah. This is outside of my area of expertise, but on the gaming side, there's so many people on their phones playing games, like mobile app games that are just dumb. I mean, I'm in El Salvador and there are people in hammocks on the side of the road and they're on cell phones or just killing time on games. There's capitalism says there's something there. It's just a matter of figuring it out.
Well, so the other blockchain that's had some big news is Aptos, and you may remember them from some of the old Facebook team that I think went and worked on that. They have a touch to earn game, I guess is what they call it, where it's like you're just pressing the screen to scratch a cat online. And what's interesting is they made every touch a blockchain transaction on the blockchain. So if you look at, and they did it for 3 days, but like the Wednesday before they started all this, they had about 875,000 transactions on the blockchain for a day. In comparison, Ethereum had about 1 million, right? You look at on Friday, a couple of days later, they had 90 million transactions that day. And then Saturday, 115. So over the 3 day period, they had 323 million transactions that were all focused on this cat scratch game, which there was only 63,000 users. So people did this for about 1,700 touches per day for 3 days, is based on how the math worked, which is just crazy. The impressive part is it was all on the blockchain, right? And they can do that kind of throughput, which is really interesting.
So the cynical nature of me and all of the scamminess of crypto, this feels like, hey, we can improve the value or perceived value of our crypto or blockchain or token or whatever based on the number of transactions. So let's make an app, a touch to earn app, and then we can have bot farms or some, you know, what, some low income country farming this so that we can show, oh, we had 300 million transactions in our blockchain, and try to boost yourself. Like, it seems like there's a cheat code here for some of these small coins to boost their numbers. And that's kind of the that's where my head goes in this situation.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like they just did it for 3 days to prove it out. So to get over 100 million transactions in a day is pretty impressive in that it can handle it. Right. If you look at, say, the Ton network, the open network, Telegram's version, they've only ever been able to get, I think, like 15 million a day. And that's been still pretty impressive too. You talk about Solana, and that's what, 50,000 per second. So I don't even know what the math is, but I mean, Ethereum has 1 million a day, right? So there, it opens up the doors for a lot of other use cases. Now that they prove this out, the question will be, will anybody come and build on it, right? That's still to be determined. But that's all that I had on my end. Anything else that I'm missing that you saw while you were down in El Salvador?
No, I mean, just like an El Salvador report so far on the first half of the trip, it's really a cool place. Like, you fly into the San Salvador airport, very modern. Like, there's, you know, local chain restaurants and things like that. It just feels like you're in any other country. I really didn't know what to expect, because 100% of the El Salvadorian information I got was through Bitcoin lenses, right? So the algorithm knows that I'm pro Bitcoin, and so I'm not getting a lot of negativity. I actually, because I have my kids here, I did a lot of research and tried to reach out to some expats and things that were here asking about safety, and like actual human beings that had moved here said, yeah, it's safe now. And so, you know, you get through, and then when you get to customs, there's a $12 per adult fee that you can pay in Bitcoin. And then, so I said, yeah, I'd like to pay in Bitcoin. And then a person came out with a credit card reader, and I'm like, okay, fine. I don't have what it takes to keep this conversation going. And once you get through that, you know, we got picked up by a transit person in a normal like van, did not speak much English at all. But so we flew in on Thursday afternoon. We, from the airport, we drove right by the presidential mansion, and so they were preparing for the inauguration. So I was able to talk enough to the driver about Bukele and stuff like that. And he was a big fan of Bukele, right? This guy, big thumbs up, smiles, you know, mostly based on the safety side of things and getting rid of gangs and putting, you know, bad guys in jail sort of stuff. And so he brought us to our tour guide for the week. And so I told my tour guide when I came in, I was like, you know, I'm not looking for to go into the cities and see, you know, modern stuff. Like, I'd like to see more nature and hikes and things like that. So it's just four of us. So, you know, we're in his 4Runner running around the crazy roads of El Salvador. And so the first place we go is to like the Santa Ana volcano. And so we did a 4.5 hour hike. And we probably could have done it in less time, but my daughter's almost 7. So, you know, we kind of went slow, but I mean, it was a legit hike. It was a challenge at the top, you know, with all rocks. The bottom part's more kind of jungle rainforest, and the top's very rocky. And then you get to the top and you can look into the cone of the volcano, and there's I'm colorblind, but it's like a turquoise green lake from all of the sulfur content in the cone. And, you know, it's an active volcano. I mean, it last erupted in 2005. And so there's some really cool stuff to do here. And so so our tour guide speaks very good English, and he's been great. And so I asked him about Bitcoin, and he kind of chuckled and said, basically everybody downloaded the Chiba wallet to get the $30, and then they forgot about it. And so he's kind of helped me figure out kind of communicate to buy stuff in Bitcoin. But I asked him, you know, have you had any other Bitcoin, like people that came to El Salvador to spend Bitcoin? And he said, no, which is kind of surprising to me that it's not generating more tourism. Now, they may stick around to smaller stuff and stay in San Salvador and go to El Dante and that's it, instead of kind of doing the countrywide tour we're on. But it's like I said, I wanted to get here and kind of get a feel for what the country's like in Bitcoin and how it operates and the adoption. And it's pretty clunky. I mean, it's kind of what you would think. Everybody likes US dollars and cash. You know, it's interesting because all the dollar, they don't have $1 bills. They have dollar coins because they have to pay for their dollars. And so the coins last forever and $1 bills only last a few years. So it's been kind of an interesting thing. I'm glad I'm here. You know, we're trying to do less touristy stuff, although I kind of felt like the bigger touristy hotels were the safer bet. You just don't know what you're going to get. But tomorrow we leave this, I mean, it's a resort type hotel on the beach, and we go to El Dante. And so we've got Airbnb in El Dante. We can walk into El Dante and check out all of the different places. And so I anticipate that being a very different experience from a Bitcoin standpoint. And so maybe next week we talk a little bit about the differences I'm seeing in El Salvador as far as that goes. But yeah, if you're like halfway wanting to go to El Salvador, I would definitely consider it. It is an inexpensive place to be. You know, we eat very well for $50 a meal. And we could eat like for a couple dollars, you know, like it's, if you look at the restaurant chains that we have in America, like Pizza Hut, personal pizzas, like, you know, different things like that. Whereas in America, I feel like you can't get lunch for under $12-$15. And okay. For me, the flights weren't very expensive. The hotels are very reasonable. The Airbnb is reasonable. And it's, you know, it's a lot of like, the cars aren't super nice. It's a Latin American country. The roads aren't very good. Their version of the interstates are good, but once you get off of those, you know, it's pretty wild. Tons of poverty on the sides of the road, you know, small houses. Like, you know, in America, it's tiny homes are cool and they're like the new thing to do. Like, these people are like tiny homes, but there's nothing to them. I mean, their cinder block construction is like seems to be the best for the low income people here. But I mean, we see like ox driven carts on the side of the road. There's a lot of people that they've not like a public transportation in these areas because you're outside of the city. And so they've got basically, if you remember like the old B2000 Mazda trucks and Nissan Datsun trucks, they have basically metal cages in the beds of the trucks. And for a quarter, you can jump on a truck and ride around, and everybody stands up in the backs of these trucks and it goes around town like it's a bus. So it's not a touristy driven country. It is a country that has a small level of tourism. The beaches are nice. The waves are not crazy hot, crazy like 6-foot waves. I mean, where we are, they have like a volcanic rock wave breaking thing. So the first 100 yards of water at the beach is more mild. When you get outside the rocks, then you've got bigger waves and you can surf and things like that. And beaches are cool, but it's not white sandy beaches, right? You're in a volcanic area, so it's a little darker, grittier sand. But I mean, you don't feel like you're in a manufactured vacation where it's your turn to stand in line for something. I mean, everywhere we go, if we're not the only English speaking people, we see like one English speaker. And so it's pretty neat to kind of immerse yourself in a country like this. Most countries that I visit are kind of at least the hotels are tailored to American tourists. So they have English speakers and things like that. But we're at a resort with, you know, big pool, like tons of rooms, like, big resort. They do not speak English at the desk. You know, I have to like do my best and break out Google Translator and teach myself Spanish real quick before I go and talk to them on like a specific issue that I have. And so it's nice to be in a place that's not tailored for Americans, because like, I feel like my kids are getting a different view of kind of a country instead of, oh, this is like little America. It's just, you know, a couple thousand miles from home. So I'm getting what I wanted out of it. I mean, we hit, when we were driving around in the 4Runner, we hit a spot in the road hard enough that the spare tire dropped out of the bottom because the cable that ties the spare tire to the bottom of the 4Runner broke. Like it's rough, man. But I do have a lot of respect for Toyotas. There's a lot of Toyotas running around here that are still operating. So I'm like, man, the Toyotas are tough to kill because this place would do it. So yeah, man, I think I can talk more about it on the Bitcoin side after this, but you know, it's funny. It's not as though 3 years after Bukele passed the El Salvador thing and had the announcement at the Miami Bitcoin conference, you know, 3 years later, it's still not mass adoption here in El Salvador. So, you know, it's something to kind of recalibrate the expectations of the time it's going to take for Bitcoin to become a medium of exchange, right? I think we're seeing it really come in as a store of value. And I think Salvadorians, if they have discretionary income and they have savings, I think that I would be curious to see how much Bitcoin they have in saving. But as far as a medium of exchange, I don't know that it's going to be a short period of time for people to adopt it.
Well, that sounds super interesting. Can't wait to hear more, but I'm going to let you get back to your vacation and could be in here with me.
No, it works. I mean, I'm sitting on the porch of my room and overlooking the pool. My kids are swimming and my wife, and the waves are coming in the shore. Like, it's not a bad way to do a podcast.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, enjoy the trip and we'll chat more next week.
Sounds good, Jason. Appreciate it.
Yeah. See you.
Adios.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below and hope to see you there.